European Union ambitions, Ukraine kept fighting on Saturday, with Kyiv's troops holding out against a Russian assault on a pivotal eastern city and communities pounded with more heavy shelling. At a summit next week, EU leaders are expected to grant Ukraine candidate status following Friday's recommendation from the bloc's executive. This put Kyiv on course to realize an aspiration seen as out of reach before the invasion, even if actual membership could take years. It's important Britain continues to show it is supporting Ukraine for the long haul, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Saturday, warning of a risk of Ukraine fatigue as the war drags on. Johnson told reporters on his arrival back in Britain from a visit to Kyiv, "The Russians are grinding forward inch by inch, and it's vital for us to show what we know to be true, which is that Ukraine can win and will win." And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited soldiers on the southern front line during a working trip to the Mykolaiv region, he said on Saturday, without specifying when the visit took place. In his trademark khaki t-shirt, the president handed out medals and posed for selfies with the servicemen in what appeared to be an underground shelter. That's according to a video posted to his official Telegram account. Meantime, President Vladimir Putin is asserting Russia's strength and resilience against a Western world that he accused of colonial arrogance and trying to crush his country with an economic blitzkrieg of sanctions. Addressing the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, he returned time and again to the theme of Russia's sovereignty in a new global order. For more stories, visit voanews.com. This is VOA News. Firefighters battled to bring raging wildfires under control in several parts of Spain on Saturday amid dry and windy conditions as a heat wave pushed temperatures close to record highs. Spain was heading towards its hottest early summer temperatures in decades on Saturday, with forecasts of between 40 to 42 degrees Celsius in Zaragoza in the northeast and areas of Navarre and La Rioja in northern Spain. That's according to the country's National Weather Agency. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Saturday he was in the process of making up his mind on easing U.S. tariffs on China and planned to speak with Chinese President Xi Jinping soon. President Biden is also saying he's not traveling to Saudi Arabia explicitly to meet de facto leader Mohammed bin Salman during a trip next month, and said he was seeing the Saudi Crown Prince as part of a broader international meeting. Biden's plans to see the Crown Prince, known as MBS, are part of his first trip to the Gulf region as president. He's been criticized by U.S. lawmakers, including some from his own Democratic Party and human rights advocates, who say the visit is at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy. Thousands of protesters took to the streets of Tunis on Saturday in opposition to a referendum on a new constitution called by the country's president that would cement his hold on power. The protest, led by the leader of the Free Constitutional Party, reflected growing opposition to the president since he seized executive power last year, dissolving parliament and ruling by decree in a move opponents call a coup. Ecuador's President Guillermo Lasso has declared a state of exception in three of the Andean country's provinces in a bid to calm protests called by indigenous groups. In rejection of the government's economic policies, curfews will be enforced and gatherings banned. Indigenous groups launched protests on Monday with demonstrators blocking roads across the country in opposition to Lasso's social and economic policies, demanding gasoline price freezes, a halt to further mining and oil projects, and more time for small farmers to pay their bank loans. For more on these and other stories making news today, please visit our website. That's voanews.com. We also have an app that you can download. Just search for VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The election is going to be determined ward by ward, local government by local government, state by state. So PDP has the tentacles, has the capacity. To some extent, the APC does have that, and we will be confronted with APC's record of misgovernance.
Nigeria's former Vice President Atiku Abubakar names Ifeanyi Okowa as his running mate ahead of next year's general election.
After transactions begin to flow and proceed between our two nations, and the president and all of us are feeling hugely optimistic, and we are buzzing with confidence like never before. So we want to believe and we trust that it will be much sooner rather than later, Peter.
Zambia's President Hakainde Hichilema ends his first official visit to Kenya. We'll have details.
Different parastatal organs, different entities of the government have presented their budget, and therefore, by the time the Minister of Finance, Planning and Economic Development is ready his budget, it is a formality, but it has already been approved and passed by Parliament long time ago.
And a Ugandan parliamentarian denies reports lawmakers received bribe to approve a supplementary budget for the State House. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, the presidential candidate for the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, has chosen Ifeanyi Okowa as his running mate ahead of next year's general election. Okowa, a former senator, is the governor of Delta State. Senior officials of the main opposition PDP welcome the choice of Okowa as a masterstroke, adding it will give Atiku's electoral prospect a significant boost. The Independent National Electoral Commission had set the deadline for presidential candidates to name their running mates for Friday. Nigerians go to the polls next year to choose a new president, senators, House of Representatives and local representatives. For more reaction from the main opposition party following the announcement of Governor Okowa as a running mate, I read spokesman for the PDP, Osita Chiduka.
Oh yes, it is a masterstroke choice, and the PDP is excited. Governor Okowa is the governor of the oil-rich Delta State. It's a state that has been plagued in the past with serious ethnic rifts and disagreements among the various ethnic groups. But in the last 8 years, he has, using his very strong political skills, navigated a very peaceful Delta State. And that has been one example of how Nigeria as a nation can be managed, managing the intra-ethnic crisis in Nigeria. So we are very happy at his choice. He is a medical doctor by profession. He is humble, widely respected in Nigeria, and a strong party member. So there's a jubilation amongst party members. And there's also a widespread joy in Nigeria that we have a credible individual, a man with very strong political skills and a quiet operator to complement the huge potentials of Alhaji Atiku Abubakar.
What does he bring to the table for Atiku's candidacy?
Well, the South-South is the bastion of the PDP in Nigeria. Delta is a very formidable state. PDP has always gotten some of his largest votes from in the South-South from Delta State. And so he brings to the table a strong state that has a known voice in the Nigerian arena. He brings a large cache of votes for the PDP. And then he also brings his strong political skills of networking his fellow governors to support the aspiration of Alhaji Abubakar Atiku. He is a widely respected quiet operator. So he brings those skills to complement Vice President Atiku's strong political network, his many years of being active in the political environment.
Does he have a broad national appeal that could significantly boost the electoral prospect of former Vice President Atiku Abubakar?
It's a very, very broad ticket, bringing in the governor of Delta, Southern Christian, widely respected, broadening the appeal of the of Atiku's ticket in Nigeria. The PDP's presidential candidate and vice presidential candidate shall bring that to the table.
From reports I'm hearing over the years, Governor Okowa seemed to have performed well, a bright spot, if you may, in Delta State. But will the youth be swayed by this choice, especially when Nigerian celebrities are rallying the youth to register to vote en masse?
Well, I think at the end of the day, the choices before Nigerians will be a choice of a party that has the tentacles to form a national government, have a controlling stake in the National Assembly, have a controlling state, number of states as governors, to hand over to the president the kind of mandate that will make it possible for him to conduct fundamental changes to Nigeria's economy, listen to the voice of the young people and be able to implement it. Now, while the young people are registering to vote, in the coming months of the election, they will be confronted by choices that will make it possible for them to choose a party that brings a strong capacity to implement agreed decisions.
So you think the PDP should be confident in next year's election, looking at the formidable or much-anticipated test that Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu will pose, and that of former Governor Peter Obi, especially, generating a lot of traction among the youth in Nigeria?
There are two ways to look at it. The qualification to be Nigeria's president requires you to win the majority of votes and to win at least 25% of the vote cast in two-thirds of Nigerian states, which translates to 24. So you have to be the very urban states and urban centers cannot determine the election. The election is going to be determined ward by ward, local government by local government, state by state. So PDP has the tentacles, has the capacity. To some extent, the APC does have that, and we will be confronted with APC's record of misgovernance, APC's record of total collapse of Nigeria's economy. As I speak to you now, the Nigerian power grid has collapsed. Diesel is at the cost of almost $1.40 in Nigeria per liter for diesel. At the cost of the 600 naira to the dollar that we have now, it's at about 800 naira. Industries are closed. Town homes do not have energy. And students of Nigerian universities are at home in one of the longest ASUU strikes we are witnessing in the recent past.
Osita Chidoka is a spokesperson for Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, a civil society group that promotes human rights, transparency and government accountability is calling on all presidential candidates to declare their assets before next year's general election. The Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project, or SERAP, petitioned all the presidential candidates to commit to declaring their assets. This, the group says, will help to ensure transparency and combat rampant corruption. The group also called on the presidential candidates to publicly announce the rejection of vote buying and election-related bribery ahead of next February's polls. Analysts say although vote buying and bribery violates electoral laws, they are widespread during voting in the West African country. To learn more about the petition for the candidates to declare their assets, I reach SERAP's spokesperson, Kalawole Oluwadare.
This is SERAP's part in contributing to the development of our democracy by bringing forward this five-point agenda, if you can call it that, in order to make the campaigns and the elections and even governance itself agenda-driven rather than what we've seen, might like it turn out to be based along religion, tribal, or strictly political lines. And so we've written an open letter to all presidential candidates in Nigeria, leading up to the general elections, to commit publicly to publish assets, details of the assets and liabilities right before now, during this campaign period, not until they are elected as president.
Why should they declare their assets before elections? Because that is not the requirement of the law as enshrined in the 1999 Constitution of Nigeria as amended.
Yes, the constitutional provisions are for public officers, but in this regard, given the rate of corruption And we've seen many politicians pay lip service to the issue of corruption, even making it a campaign issue. So it is only natural if to put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, to demonstrate that capability to be transparent and accountable if they are eventually elected. To do that now as individuals who are vying for public office, there may appear to be no specific constitutional provisions for these, being that they are not public officers in the strict sense. But to demonstrate their commitment to the ideals of transparency and accountability, and anti-corruption being a major focus of corruption campaigns over the years, and naturally it is something they should be willing to do. And I see no reason why anybody vying for public office, particularly as the president, will not want to do this. After all, it's all in the interest of transparency and accountability and a rich democratic experience.
What are the other asks that Serap wants these presidential candidates to commit to in the run-up to next year's election?
We have five. So the other four is for them to publicly reject and make statements rejecting the practice of vote buying and any kind of electoral malpractice, both before and during the forthcoming elections. Thirdly, we're asking them to commit to probing the spendings, government expenditure on security votes from 1999 till date. And fourth, we're asking them to also prove the spending on electricity over the years, which stands at nothing less than 11 trillion naira, and enough to bring power to all Nigerians. And last but not the least, to publicly commit to obeying orders of court in line with the principles of the rule of law.
Bakaole, what about the issue of security? Because a lot of Nigerians have expressed concern about security in the north. Now it's even coming to the south. We heard reports of church worshippers who were gunned down by unknown gunmen or by assailants. So insecurity is spreading across the length and breadth of Nigeria. So what about the issue of security?
What we've tried to do is to capture as much as possible the salient points in this five-point agenda. But looking at the top point on security votes, it addresses the issue of insecurity squarely. So we have a practice in Nigeria called security votes where public officers, right from the president to even the local officers, earn what is called security votes, which is not backed by any statutory provision at all. There is no law that allows the spending of these, but several billions of naira are spent annually on security votes, and which we've had public officials explain as for them to act as security officers in their various domains.
For all the leading political parties and their presidential aspirants have announced their determination to fight corruption. So if they commit to some of these acts you've asked them for the 5 points, how are you going to hold them accountable for their commitments leading up to the election or when they are elected?
The idea is for the electorate, who are the most important stakeholder in this electoral process, to hold them accountable, not only for the manifesto they put out on the public poll, these commitments also, which will form a sort of agenda setting for the campaign, the election itself, then ultimately who becomes the president. So the idea is for the electorate to hold these individuals accountable for the things they said, and we hope and really believe that these pertinent questions will be asked in the various campaign events leading up to the election themselves, so that we have a robust engagement, they call it a public debate, as it were, both between among the contestants and even in their followers also, which will then enrich our democratic experience and make sure that the elections and the campaign themselves are issue-based.
Kalawole Oluwadare is the spokesperson for the Socioeconomic Rights and Accountability Project, or SERAP. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Zambia's President Hakainde Hichilema ended his first official visit to Kenya Thursday. Talks between the Zambian leader and his host, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, centered on strengthening bilateral and trade relations between the two countries. Hichilema called for the removal of trade barriers among African countries. This, after expressing concern that goods between Lusaka and Nairobi, in some cases, had to go through Europe due to trade barriers, a process he says does not make sense. On his part, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta pledged his government's commitment to removing obstacles between his country and Zambia, as well as with other African countries. The Zambian leader has since returned to Zambia following his visit to Kenya. for the anticipated impact the visit will have on Zambia's economy, businesses, and citizens, I reached presidential spokesperson Anthony Bwalya.
The president did hold bilateral talks with President Uhuru Kenyatta, with a particular focus on how the two countries can collaborate in expanding our mutual trade and investment potential in areas of tourism, agriculture, technology, amongst others. I have to mention that special emphasis was placed on intra-Africa trade links, because we have to recognize that it is absolutely important that we are able to aggressively trade amongst ourselves as neighboring regional and continental nations. I also have to mention, Peter, that a number of MOUs were signed between our two countries in areas of tourism, promotion of cooperatives between the two nations. We have to be able to mention that there's an MOU between the Zambia Development Agency and the Kenya Investment Authority, with a special emphasis on unlocking trade and investment opportunities between the two nations by robust dealing.
Anthony, talking about trade and investment, the president expressed concern that sometimes it's more convenient for Zambia to trade with Kenya through Europe, and he thinks that doesn't really make sense. Yeah. So did they thrash out all these to remove the barriers to enhance trade?
And the president is absolutely right. And I think this is why you are seeing this renewed energy in the structure of our economic diplomacy agenda, and again, particularly focusing on trade and investment. We think that there are huge opportunities to be carved out and to be exploited if our respective nations within the neighboring region on the continent can engage and trade much more robustly and aggressively on a much more direct and bilateral basis than having to use third-party channels in faraway places as a way to engage. We think that this would not only be able to lower costs, but we think that it is going to lead to a renewed trust, not just at the political level, but also at an investment level. We think that that is the future of trade on the African continent. We think that that is the future of trade in our country.
Anthony, what are the expectations of the government in Lusaka following the president's trip and the memorandum of understanding and agreements signed between President Hichilema and President Uhuru Kenyatta?
Yeah, look, the president made it very clear that we need to be able to move very quickly to the next level and the next step, which is actualizing and transforming those agreements into actual transactions, because it is as a result of those actual transactions that we are going to see many more businesses, for example, proceeding from Kenya into Zambia and from Zambia into Kenya. And it is only when that begins to happen that we are going to see jobs being created in Zambia and in Kenya. It is only when that sort of thing happens that we're going to see actual incomes begin to descend into people's pockets and into people's homes, and subsequently into the communities where they live.
How long do you think this will translate into something beneficial that Zambians will experience or enjoy and will be beneficial to them?
Yeah, Peter, you ask a very good question, and I'll be candid with you. The president and the new administration here in Lusaka are bullish, and we are in a hurry. We're in a hurry because the Zambian people are in a hurry. We signed MOUs with Kenya in areas of tourism, promoting cooperatives, boosting investment support and cooperation between the Zambia Development Agency and the Kenya Investment Authority to unlock those opportunities that exist. Our people cannot wait. We wasted a whole 10 years where an economy that had been growing at over 6% had declined into negative territory. We need to rebuild this economy. And in order to rebuild that economy, we absolutely need to boost trade and investment opportunities between this country and other nations. So as the president returns to Lusaka, work, critical work, will start. It has already started. Looking at modalities of how those memoranda of understanding can and will be actualized and transitioned into actual transactions. And we hope that in the soonest period of time possible, we will begin actual transactions begin to flow and proceed between our two nations. And the president and all of us are feeling hugely optimistic, and we are buzzing with confidence like never before. So we want to believe and we trust that it will be much sooner rather than later, Peter.
Anthony Bwalya is the spokesperson for President Hakainde Hichilema. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. A Ugandan parliamentarian is denying reports that lawmakers were bribed to approve a supplementary budget for the State House. Felix Ongwech Adupa, a parliamentarian from the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM, says it is illegal for any lawmaker to take bribes or be unduly influenced to approve a budget. He challenged anybody with proof to make it public. His remarks come following local media reports that lawmakers have been paid at least $10,000 each to approve the supplementary budget for the government. The finance minister had presented a $13 billion budget with over $20 million supplementary for the State House. Civil society groups are demanding an investigation into the bribery allegations. But analysts say their demands for an independent inquiry are not likely to succeed. For more reaction to the approval of the budget, I reach parliamentarian Felix Ongwench Adupa.
As NRM, this budget of 2022-2023 financial year budget is focused on economic recovery. We are trying to recover from 2 years pandemic that COVID has really affected businesses. At the same time, people have not been doing well financially. So we are looking at recovery of the economy with the 48 trillion Uganda shillings. Among the key issues that the budget has touched on, it is what we are calling Paris Development Model, where the government is trying to fight poverty from the Paris level. The national government has decided to empower the people right away from the community, from the villages to the parishes, whereby you can have money of the Paris Development Model, and these resources can help you to get out of poverty. So one of the key aspects of 2022-2023 financial year budget, it is.
Some people have said previous budget that the government presented to Parliament, the objectives were not met, and that this is not going to be different, and that this is just for senior officials to feed off the taxpayers' money without necessarily addressing the core issues or economic challenges Ugandans face. How do you respond to that?
What we are fighting on as the NRM and also as a cadre of NRM, what we are fighting on that has been affecting the progress of our economy has been corruption. This has been a serious pandemic itself to the government. You realize that at a certain point, when the government funds in good faith to do certain development projects, let's say infrastructure development, you find that there are certain cult groups of corrupt leaders who does not want this money to serve its purpose. So this has been a problem of the NRM government. And we acknowledge it, there are challenges in terms of corruption, but at the same time, we cannot relent and sit down and fail to tackle our issues as a country. We need to tackle our issues as a country while fighting corruption at the same time.
How does this budget address the issue of skyrocketing commodity prices and goods and services? Because opposition groups, including Tshisekedi, have been campaigning and calling on the government to come up with solutions to try to ease the economic burden Ugandans are facing. And they said that this budget will do nothing of that to address their concerns. How do you respond to that?
You see, when with due respect, the retired Colonel Dr. Besigye is talking about skyrocketing price of commodities that has now been seen to be a very serious challenge, it is not only Uganda that is facing the challenge. It is worldwide. You are very aware that the conflict between Ukraine and Russia has caused most of the country a lot of problems. Right now, when you are talking about high price of food, first of all, they are not considering that we are also now fighting with climate change, okay? It does not rain the way it used to rain. That is one thing that people are not understanding. So the farmers are not receiving that rainfall that we used to receive for a better farming season. Therefore, this is not a challenge of Uganda. It's a global challenge, and I believe even you in Washington, you are now facing certain challenges in certain aspects. So it's not only Uganda.
There are reports that members of parliament, including yourself, were paid bribes in order to approve the budget. How do you respond to such reports?
That is a malicious allegation. That is baseless allegation that should not even test the stand of public consumption, because it is not true that the parliament, members of parliament, has received 40 million Uganda shilling each to pass the budget. It is a constitutional mandate, a constitutional responsibility of members of parliament to pass a national budget. And one thing that people should know is that before even the budget is passed by parliament, it enters into certain committee level. This budget has been scrutinized by parliament. This budget has been checked by parliament. Different parastatal organs, different entities of the government have presented their budget. And therefore, by the time the Minister of Finance, Planning and Economic Development is reading budget, it is a formality, but it has already been approved and passed by parliament long time ago.
Felix Ongwench Adupa is a Ugandan parliamentarian from the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, a group of refugees in South Africa have been camped in front of UN offices since last month, begging to be moved to a third country because of xenophobia. The refugees from Burundi, Congo, Malawi, and Rwanda say returning to their home countries is not safe, and they no longer feel welcome in South Africa. For VOA, Linda Giftash reports from the South African capital, Pretoria.
Dozens of refugees camped outside the United Nations Refugee Agency office say they've been living in South Africa for 2 decades, but now they no longer feel safe. Most of them are from the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they escaped war. But increasingly, they say they've had their small businesses looted, homes robbed, and been personally attacked amid growing waves of xenophobia. Lillian Nyota has been a refugee in South Africa since 2001.
We ran away from our country, running from tribulations. We came here in South Africa. We found more trouble, more tribulations, because xenophobic attack is real. Xenophobia is real. No one can deny it. It's real.
South Africa is home to more than 250,000 asylum seekers. This group says they've moved from community to community, but violence eventually follows. Nyota says they're now asking the United Nations Refugee Agency to move them to a safe third country.
Any place that they can take us, that's where we can be safe with our families. We can live and move on with our lives so that our children can go to school.
Xenophobic violence has become increasingly pronounced in South Africa, with bursts of riots and murder since 2008. Earlier this year, amid a wave of anti-migrant marches, a Zimbabwean man was killed in a Johannesburg township, authorities say, because of his nationality. Experts blame the problem on the country's history of violence, socioeconomic issues, and growing anti-foreigner politics. Silindile Mlelo is a researcher at the University of Witwatersrand.
Normally when there's with xenophobic violence is that when it happens, there's no differentiation of like, are you refugee, are you asylum seeker? You know, if government is not seen as doing anything, it also discourages migrants and refugees who are in the country, because it's like, is it safe for me?
Resettlement is not an option for most refugees. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says only 1% of refugees globally are moved from one host country to another for exceptional circumstances. Laura Padawan is the spokesperson for UNHCR South Africa.
It's really only the most vulnerable refugees who are eligible for resettlement. So that can be survivors of sexual or gender-based violence. It can be women and children at risk, people at risk because of their religious persecution. We really urge those refugees to take up the offer of local integration or repatriation, because no one wants to see people living out on the street.
But these refugees outside her office maintain reintegration is not an option and say they will stay camped there until there's a plan for them to leave South Africa. Linda Giftash, VOA News, Pretoria.
In marking the World Day to Combat Desertification and Drought, the United Nations is calling for better land management and regreening initiatives to tackle the twin disasters. For viewer Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Europe is struggling with an unusually early and intense heat wave, which has spread from North Africa. That has been preceded by a prolonged heat wave in India and Pakistan in March and April. Spokeswoman for the World Meteorological Organization, Claire Nullis, says European countries are experiencing scorching temperatures in mid-June that are more typical of those in July or August. She says temperatures more than 10 degrees higher than average are combined with drought in many parts of Europe.
As a result of climate change, heat waves are starting earlier. They're becoming more frequent and more severe because of concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which are at record level. What we're witnessing today is unfortunately a foretaste of the future.
Heat waves can exacerbate drought and wildfires and trigger desertification. The WMO says droughts are increasing in frequency and severity. It says they have gone up by 29% since 2000, affecting 55 million people a year. The World Health Organization calls drought an urgent global issue. It says droughts are getting more frequent and fiercer in all regions, affecting the health and well-being of millions of people. WHO spokeswoman Carla Drysdale says a particularly hard-hit region is the Greater Horn of Africa.
In the past 10 years, the region has endured three severe droughts. The frequency and severity of droughts in recent years linked to the changing climate has made it harder and harder for families to recover from these shocks. Millions in the Greater Horn of Africa are facing acute hunger.
UN agencies agree early action can avert a crisis, lessen the impact of drought, and reverse desertification. They say measures such as rainwater harvesting, drip irrigation systems, and crop engineering that increases resilience to dry conditions can ward off some of the worst effects of drought. They recommend better land management, tree planting, and other regreening projects to combat desertification and restore the land to what it was. They point to the Great Green Wall of the Sahel Project in Africa, which already has restored millions of hectares of land and created thousands of jobs from Dakar, Senegal, to Djibouti. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Anybody will won't fight you. Let them come, they already know. I'll be right beside you. Like the wall of Jericho. They don't know, they don't know. They don't know what's going on. When I get to, when I get to, when I get to my baby boy. I'll be a soldier for you. I'm guessing that I am home. You should know I got you. And you don't need to guide me to. I'll be right beside you in anything that you do. If you ever need me, I will be running to you. Running, running, running to you. I'll be running to you. Running, running, running to you. Anywhere that you go to, running, running, running to you. I've been running to you, running, running, running to you. Anywhere that you go to.
When I'm looking for trouble, it's cause I know that I got you. When you must bless everybody, oh, oh. And it's because of your kung fu. I don't need time that I'm out of control. You never, never let go. Una kiso, una kiso, una kiso, my baby boo. See all the problems you'll be fighting, and I'll be right there with you. I may be small, but I'm mighty, and I go running for you. And anybody wakes up, yeah, don't be you pull it up, big around.
let you go to. I've been running, running to you.
Yeah. la vie. J'ai choisi de t'aimer, j'aimerais que tu retiennes. Tu retiennes, tu sais, je ne suis qu'un homme différent. J'en reverrai, je souviens-tu du temps. Tu ne savais pas qui j'étais, un homme imprévisible. C'est tout ce dont tu rêvais. Dis-moi que tu m'aimes, que tu m'aimes. C'est la vie.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a hunter with only one arrow does not shoot carelessly. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.